This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question today comes from John Palmer, who asks, has the three equal body problem ever been solved mathematically yet? A recent TV documentary discussing gravity assist missions implied that computer simulations and graph paper were still needed.
Well, we usually dispense with the graph paper these days, but the computer simulations are very definitely still required. Now, a little background for the everyday listener here. We'll start off with a two-body problem. No giggling at the back there. The two-body problem states that if you have two objects orbiting each other, like the Earth and the Moon, the motion can be described by a single equation. So the Moon orbits the Earth in an ellipse. The two-body problem was solved by Johann Kepler in the 17th century, so we've known about it for quite a while. But what happens if you introduce a third body? Well, mathematically speaking, the system becomes chaotic, and each body's orbit can't be simply described by a single equation. So you can't predict exactly where the body will be at any point in time simply by putting numbers into equations. You actually have to follow each body and compute how the gravity of the other two bodies pulls on it. So there'll never be an algebraic solution to the three-body problem. But that's not to say that we don't know what's going to happen. After all, we know the Moon goes round the Earth once every month, and the Earth goes round the Sun once every year. More accurately, the Moon and the Earth orbit each other around the centre of mass, and the Earth and the Sun orbit each other too. But we'll ignore this detail for the moment. But that's good enough for everyday work. However, if you're sending a spacecraft up there, you'll need to be rather more precise than that. If you're going to land a probe on the Moon, it's no good being out by a few hundred miles. So what this simple view ignores is the fact that the Sun also pulls on the Moon, and that distorts its orbit slightly. It's not enough to be very obvious if you're just standing on Earth, but the effect is there nonetheless, and that makes its orbit impossible to solve with algebra alone. If you're sending probes to other planets, there's a whole heap of other things you need to worry about. You need to worry about the gravity of all the planets, and sometimes a few of the asteroids too. For example, the pull of Jupiter's gravity on the Earth is about 0.6% of the Moon's, and that's enough to raise tides for a few centimetres in the oceans. So if you're sending probes out, what you thought was a three-body problem might easily become a 13-body problem, or even worse. Now, fortunately, systems like the 13-body problem are quite trivial for a computer to solve over the lifetime of a spacecraft. There are entire systems, such as NASA Horizons, that are dedicated to doing just that. So it's much easier than fiddling around with slide rules and graph paper like in the old days. Turns out modern rocket science isn't that hard after all.
Excellent, excellent. Now our second question comes from Andrew Horner, who asks, how does a planet with four suns have an apparently stable orbit?
Well, the planet in question here is PH1. It's a planet announced in October and has been discovered by members of the public. It's orbiting a stellar system that's been monitored by the Kepler satellite, and that's got the romantic name of KIC 4862625. The system has four stars, and we now know at least one planet. Now, we heard in the last question that all the planets in the solar system pull on each other and slightly destabilize each other's orbits. If we were to replace three of the planets in the solar system with normal stars, it would wreak merry havoc and throw all the other planets out into space. So how can a planet with four suns have a stable orbit? Well, for example, man-made satellites can orbit the Earth in circular orbits, because to them the Earth looks like a sphere. Well, we know that's not quite true. The Earth's a bit more interesting than that. It's got mountains and other bumps and things like that. But satellites don't really care about that. They're in almost circular orbits because the Earth is very close to spherical. Satellites stay in those orbits and aren't pulled out by the Moon or other planets because the Earth's gravity is that much stronger. Everything else is too far away or too small for them to care about. That's also true for these four stars. The stars are in two pairs. Now, the first pair orbit each other every 20 days or so, and this is the pair that the planet goes around. The stars are close enough together that the planet only sees them as one object, and it goes around in a nearly circular orbit. The second pair of stars orbits each other every few hundred years, but they're separated from the first pair of stars by about 1,000 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun, 1,000 AU. And the two pairs take many thousands of years to go around each other. So the second pair of stars is simply too far away for the planet to care about. Now, if you find this scenario a little difficult to follow and appreciate it's not very good just coming through an audio channel, then try this. If you were to put a spacecraft in orbit around both Pluto and Charon, it could orbit quite happily. Pluto and Charon are close enough together that the spacecraft only sees them as one object, as far as gravity is concerned anyway. But that spacecraft won't really care about the Earth and the Moon, because they're so far away. The combined gravity of Pluto and Charon will be much greater. Despite there being four big chunks of rock to worry about here, the spacecraft can still happily only orbit two of them. And more generally, some orbits are stable and some aren't. But basically, if you can treat the thing that you're orbiting as one object, and you aren't pulled up too much by other objects, then you're in a stable orbit.
Our final question comes from Margaret Feaster, who asks, Venus lost its water due to evaporation. How much of the lost water from Venus ended up on Earth?
If you've been watching Tim, Brian and Dara on Stargazing Live, you'll know that planets that are too hot, like Venus, or planets that are too small or have no magnetic field, like Mars, have lost most of their water because it evaporates off into space. And we think that all terrestrial planets in the solar system started out with atmospheres that are mainly hydrogen and helium, but that these were rapidly lost as the planets evolved. Venus and Mars also lost the nitrogen and water, and their oxygen was rapidly turned to carbon dioxide, leaving them with the atmospheres we see today. Now, working out how much water Venus started out with is actually quite tricky. We don't really know how much there was, but probably only enough to make it slightly damp, maybe the equivalent of covering it to a few meters in depth. Now, that makes a million cubic kilometers of water, and that sounds a lot, but it's an awful lot less than the billion cubic kilometers of water in the Earth's oceans. That water evaporated off Venus fairly quickly, over the first few hundred million years. So there wasn't really an awful lot of water on Venus to start off with. But we can still ask how much of that ended up on Earth. Now, gases escaping from planets are typically blown away from the planet by the solar wind, very much like the tail of a comet. So a fair amount of Venus's lost water would cross the Earth's orbit as it's blown from the sun. But quite a lot would also go above and below our orbit. The Earth's gravity's fairly weak, so anything that doesn't actually hit us will just pass us by. Rather less than a millionth of the material that is ejected from Venus would impact the Earth. So from your million cubic kilometres of water that were ejected from Venus originally, maybe rather less than one cubic kilometre would have made it to Earth. Maybe enough to fill a small reservoir. We don't know exactly where the water on Earth today came from, how much of it was part of Earth to begin with, and how much came from other sources. But it's probable that at least some of it came from ice-rich comets early on in the Earth's history. So next time you turn on the tap and take a drink, remember, you're drinking well-filtered comet juice.
Thank you very much for all those brilliant answers. And if you have any questions that you want answering, send them in by all the usual channels.